From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, performing abortions in small towns where other doctors are afraid to. We talk with Dr. Susan Wickland. She runs a clinic in Montana. For several years, she commuted between clinics in three states. She has been stalked and threatened by anti-abortion protesters who have also surrounded her house. Also today, virtual communities. We talk with Howard Rheingold, author of a new book about how people are communicating through computer networks. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Pentagon says a Coast Guard cutter fired shots across the bow of a merchant ship bound for Haiti today after the ship refused to change its course. The cutter is part of the flotilla enforcing the UN embargo against Haiti. It had ordered the ship to turn away from Haiti because Coast Guard officers who boarded the ship were unable to inspect part of its cargo. The United States sought to increase the pressure on individual Haitian leaders today by freezing the assets of 41 people identified as senior military and police officials of the regime that seized power in 1991. The U.S. Army Rangers in Somalia started packing up today, and the first contingent left for home. NPR's Michael Scholar reports from Mogadishu.
The Rangers came to Somalia in late August with a mission: to find and capture General Mohamed Farah Aidid, the man thought to have ordered a series of violent attacks on UN peacekeepers. The specially trained force made lightning-fast raids on suspected Aidid strongholds, capturing some of Aidid's top aides. But there were also blunders, like a raid where Rangers swooped in and mistakenly captured UN aid workers. In the last 2 weeks, American policy has changed, and the Rangers have lost their mission. The U.S. has said it will no longer try to arrest Aidid and now wants to coax him back into negotiations. But even as the Rangers leave, new U.S. reinforcements are arriving in Somalia with tanks and other heavy weapons and with a new, more limited mission: to protect U.S. and U.N. peacekeepers if they come under attack once again. This is Michael Scholar in Mogadishu.
Four Democratic and Republican senators have jointly presented legislation for health care reform. The new plan is a match for a bill introduced into the House earlier this month that now has 50 sponsors. NPR's Joanne Silberner has this report.
Both the House and Senate bills use the same approach as President Clinton's plan: managed competition. That's where businesses and individuals buy their insurance through purchasing cooperatives that are regulated by the government. But the Clinton plan would require employers to purchase insurance for their workers, and everyone would be covered. The new House and Senate bills have no employer mandate and don't guarantee coverage. Democratic Senator John Breaux of Louisiana says his new bill is not meant to supersede the president's plan.
This is a constructive effort to meet in the middle. We are offering this not in competition with the administration, but in an effort to work with them and our Republican colleagues to get something that can pass.
The president's legislation is expected to be introduced next Wednesday. This is Joanne Silberner in Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 9 points to close at 3,636. Declines led advances by a slight margin in heavy trading. This is NPR News. Negotiators for Israel and the Palestine Liberation Organization say they've agreed on a phased release of Palestinians held in Israeli prisons. A Palestinian delegate said that priority will be given to women, prisoners who are ill, the aged, and the very young. The Israeli delegation said the release of prisoners will be implemented gradually and continually and will begin next week. Prudential Securities is going to pay a multi-million-dollar fine to settle charges that it engaged in improper sales tactics. From member station WNYC, Don Matheson reports.
Prudential Securities will pay out $371 million. The bulk of the money will be used to compensate investors who were sold high-risk partnerships when they thought they were making safe investments for their savings. The alleged improprieties occurred during the boom days of the 1980s. In reaching the settlement, Prudential Securities did not admit or deny wrongdoing. Officials say it's one of the largest agreements of its kind, second only to the $650 million paid out by the now-defunct junk bond powerhouse Drexel Burnham Lambert. Others in line to get money from the deal include the Securities and Exchange Commission, which regulates Wall Street firms. For National Public Radio, I'm Don Matheson in New York.
President Clinton defended his health care plan today in a speech to business leaders. Recent polls have shown that public support for the president's plan has been waning as the administration's attention was drawn away from the issue by a series of international crises. The president denied claims that his program would create a giant bureaucracy and push the nation too quickly toward guaranteed health coverage for all Americans. He said that his health care purchasing alliances would merely give small businesses and individuals the same bargaining power that big corporations already enjoy. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest has been threatened with death because of the work she does. Dr. Susan Wicklund performs abortions, and she works in regions where few, if any, doctors are willing to do it. Dr. Wicklund is now the medical director of a clinic in Bozeman, Montana, but for several years she was commuting back and forth between clinics in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and North Dakota in communities that otherwise would have had little or no access to abortion. Her refusal to be intimidated has won her many honors. The latest will be presented next week by the Elizabeth Blackwell Healthcare Center for Women in Philadelphia. Earlier this month, several abortion rights groups sent letters to Attorney General Janet Reno demanding that attacks on abortion clinics or doctors be classified as a form of domestic terrorism. I asked Dr. Wicklund if she felt she was adequately protected by local law enforcement.
Yes and no. There's been a couple of instances where some of the law enforcement officers just didn't know what to do. I'm thinking of an incident in my home where there was a number of protesters at night, and the local law enforcement agency just did not have enough officers to be able to deal with them. They had said they would wait and deal with it in the morning. In the meantime, that meant that we had people on our property and surrounding our home all night long with no protection. We had to wait till daylight. It felt pretty strange to not be protected at night, but it would be protected in the daytime.
This is because there weren't enough officers on the night shift?
There weren't enough officers in the entire county. This is a rural county in northern Minnesota.
So what did you do all night?
We stayed inside the house with the doors locked and the lights off and waited till morning.
And what was the protest like that was going on outside your house?
Well, there was actually protesters outside of our house many nights for a little better than a month in the fall of 1991, and that's the time period that I'm talking about. So different nights were different scenarios. Sometimes it'd be three or four people, sometimes 50 or 60 people outside of the house. Some nights would sneak out and get to a vehicle and so I could get to work the next morning. Some nights we stayed all night if I didn't have to go to work the next day. There was a long time when my daughter was taken to and from school in a police car because the protesters would let the police car enter and leave our property when it had her, when they were transporting her back and forth.
I know at one point you had hired bodyguards. Do you still have personal bodyguards?
I have one clinic that I always have a personal bodyguard with me whenever I go in and out of the building. That's a clinic in Bozeman, Montana. I work at a clinic in Fargo, North Dakota, and they also have hired security at that clinic whenever there's clinic days.
Do you feel protected when you have bodyguards, or do you still feel vulnerable?
Unfortunately, I feel that if there's somebody out there crazy enough to risk their life or to sacrifice themselves to hurt me or any other person, that they'll probably be successful in doing that regardless of what precautions I take. The precautions I do take, I hope, will deter the person who's not quite over the edge that much and will respect a guard dog or a weapon or someone walking beside me.
Your bodyguards are armed?
Sometimes and sometimes not.
I know some doctors who provide abortions have taken to wearing bulletproof vests to protect themselves. Is that a precaution you take?
I frequently wear a bulletproof vest, yes.
What are some of the ways you've been harassed? You mentioned the demonstrations outside of your home.
We've had stuff going on for a number of years, everything from people in airports screaming at us, screaming at other passengers to not get on with that baby killer, letters, phone calls in the night, vandalism to the home or vehicles, people stalking or following me to and from work, to my home, etc., harassing my daughter. Flyers around the town. Recently, there was a wanted poster that was put up at a hotel in Bozeman, Montana, with my face on it, saying that I was wanted for the murder of young boys and girls, and reward. That caused quite a stir in the town. Thankfully, the townspeople were very intolerant of this man's behavior and have put a stop to that poster immediately.
It sounds like usually when you're followed, it's to and from work. Do you have people following you when you're just going to the grocery, when you're just
happened.
Your personal life?
Yeah, it's happened many times in the past. It hasn't been as frequent recently, and I believe it's because of this anti-stalking law that has been passed in a number of states. And in fact, all the states that I'm currently working do have anti-stalking laws, and it seems to have made a huge impact in how much harassment I'm getting on a personal basis coming to and from work.
Have you had to become an expert in how to identify somebody?
Oh, absolutely. I'm always aware of who's around me, which cars have been following me for a number of blocks, which people I've seen in an airport more than one time. Quite good at recognizing faces from various cities when they come to other areas that I'm at, picking out those people who I feel are watching me for whatever reason.
Some doctors gave up providing abortions after Dr. David Gunn was murdered in Florida. What was your reaction after the murder? Did you feel more afraid? Did it put doubts in your mind about continuing with your work?
I definitely was more afraid. I was traveling with my father to go to a concert in Iowa, and I stopped at a gas station and had called back to my office just to see how things were going, and was told there was some bad news and that Jane Bovard in Fargo wanted to give it to me herself. So I called Jane, and she told me that Dr. Gunn had been murdered. And I remember sitting down on the floor below the phone in the gas station in a little town in northern Iowa, just crying and crying. And my father came in and said, what was wrong? And I told him that one of the abortion doctors had been murdered. And he just held me, and it was like, I wondered, what's going on? How can this possibly be happening? It was, of course, there was doubts. You know, I want to live, but I also have real strong convictions, and it meant then that I had to take even more precautions and more safety and spend more money trying to make sure that I was protected as much as possible, but yet realizing that no one can be protected all the time and that we're always vulnerable in some area. But no, I am not going to quit my work.
For about 3.5 years, you worked in, well, several states. You were living in Minnesota, but you worked in Appleton, Wisconsin, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Duluth, Minnesota, St. Paul, Minnesota, and Fargo, North Dakota. In all of those places, they couldn't find doctors to provide abortions, and you had to fly in?
That's correct. The clinic in Milwaukee was one of three clinics in that area, possibly four at that time, and there was just a handful of doctors keeping those clinics open, and all the clinics were quite busy. I'm no longer working there, and they are having a hard time getting enough clinic days, from what I understand, but at least there's other clinics in the area patients can go to. In Appleton, there are no other clinics in that area, and I was the only physician traveling to that clinic at that time.
So what was your schedule like, traveling to all these different states?
Absolutely crazy. I was on the road most every day of the week. Sometimes I would have six clinics in 6 days. Sometimes I'd have seven clinics in 6 days, working a day clinic one place and a night clinic someplace else, just to keep it the services going. I spent many, many nights in motels, lots of nights for a while, driving from one place to the other. This was during the height of the protesters, so that I could avoid airports for a while. The clinic in Duluth has a couple of different physicians that we would rotate, and they are also now a little shorter, but they are keeping their days going. The clinic in Fargo is the most critical as far as I'm concerned. It's the only clinic in North Dakota. There's two of us that are currently working there and have been for the last 5 years. We alternate weeks. If either one of us stops working, it'll put a real hard burden on the other person, probably a burden that wouldn't be able to be carried completely. So we are real determined to keep that clinic going with both of us working.
Why did you decide to stop going to some of the clinics that you'd been working at and to instead start working at the clinic in Bozeman?
There was a number of reasons. Some of them have to do with a preference on where I would like to eventually be living, and that's in the mountains in Montana. The Bozeman Clinic became available almost a year ago now when the physician that had been running it for 12 years wanted to retire at the age of 72, and I decided to take over the clinic. It was real important to me that after having spent 4 years of traveling around to a variety of clinics, being like a subcontractor, I guess you could say, for other clinics, that I finally get into a place where I felt I could make some of the major decisions on patient care, on counseling, on post-op care, on things that to me were real crucial and that I wanted to be able to have more control with.
So what were some of the changes you made in the Bozeman Clinic, changes that were congruent with what you thought should be done in clinics?
To me, the most crucial part for any woman faced with that decision is the emotional part of it. Has she gone through all of her options? Does she have good support? Is this really what she wants to do, or is it somebody else that's trying to coerce or push her into having an abortion? I do not do abortions for husbands or boyfriends or mothers. I do them only when the woman decides in her heart this is the best decision for her. And we sometimes have patients that we spend, you know, 2 hours talking with before they get anywhere close to the procedure room and completely explain everything. I want them to know exactly what's going on, to have complete informed consent to all parts of the procedure. And there are sometimes we get, after spending an hour with a patient, that it's obvious that this really is not the decision that they want. And whether they're able to vocalize it or not, we sometimes send people home and say, I know your voice is saying yes, but your heart and your body language is saying no, and you need to go home and think about it more. Perhaps you'll come back, perhaps you won't. I have women get angry at me sometimes saying that it's their choice and I have to do the abortion, and I'll say, I don't have to do the abortion. That's my choice too. And generally, if those women come back, they're very grateful that they've been sent away and that they have had the extra time. The far majority of women, when they walk into the clinic, have thought about it. They know where they're at with it. They're real comfortable with it. They need some more counseling just to understand the procedure. They do not need to wait another 24 hours, 48 hours, 1 week, whatever. But the few people that do, I think, is crucial that they get that extra time and that we insist on it.
How can you tell, how do you evaluate if a woman is there to have an abortion because of her boyfriend or her parent, not because she really wants it?
After 5 years of doing this, there are so many signals that I have become attuned to with the women. Usually it's body language,
like
not making good eye contact,
mm-hmm.
Moving in different ways when you're about to do an exam. Sometimes it'll be some of the words they use when you're talking about abortion in general. There's many, many signals, and some of them more subtle than others. Generally, if I can, and I always do, get alone with the patient and just look them in the eye and really, really start talking to their heart and to their head and not just to the intellect and not just to the words that they've heard come out of their mother's voice, mother's mouths or their boyfriend's mouths, you can generally get the women to really speak from their heart and tell what's going on with them.
My guest is Dr. Susan Wicklund. She runs an abortion clinic in Bozeman, Montana. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Susan Wicklund. She performs abortions in spite of the many threats against her. Would you say that anti-abortion protesters have been changing their tactics recently? Have you seen any change in the past few months?
We've actually noticed an interesting change in a number of places. It appears to me, from having watched this for the last 5 years, that some of the people that I would call normal protesters, this is people, that is, that are truly out there to exercise their freedom of speech, who are carrying signs that are not terribly offensive, but at least speaking their mind, but people that are not going to be the violent people. They seem to be less in numbers in front of the clinics now. And my interpretation of this is that they are afraid now of being lumped together with the absolute crazies out there, the ones who will firebomb the clinics, who will slash tires, who will shoot at doctors. And instead of being associated with the violent people, they've chosen to not be in front of the clinics at all. That's what I see. So I think the tactics have changed to be more violent. The few people that are still actively protesting are much scarier to me. I'm real worried about what's going to be happening in the next year. I feel like they've lost on many political grounds, and their only hope, as far as they see it, is to do the real drastic things that we've seen a sharp increase in the last 6-8 months.
What keeps you doing this, in spite of the threats against you?
I grew up in a real strong Scandinavian family in northern Wisconsin, and I just have always been taught and have always believed that you do what you believe in. And I feel that the kinds of response I get from my patients, the kinds of things that I see on a daily basis, and the support that I get from my family have all kept me going and will continue to keep me going. The bottom line is the patients, though. On a daily basis, when the people that I see, the people that I take care of, the stories I hear, the situations they're in, the things they dream about and hope about for their futures, all of that is what keeps me working with them. I think that abortion has to be safe and legal. I've had a horrible experience myself many, many years ago with an abortion where people did not explain to me what was going on. They didn't talk about what to expect before, during, and after the abortion, and I was terrified, and it was a horrible experience. It was still the right choice. I'm glad I went through with it. I'm glad I ended that pregnancy, but it should not have been done in such a traumatic way, and I am very determined to make sure that as many women as possible who choose to go that route, who choose to end their pregnancy, go through it in a compassionate, supportive, healthy environment, and I'm trying my hardest to provide that environment for people.
Did that experience have anything to do with your deciding to become a doctor or to perform abortions?
It had nothing to do with my decision to become a doctor, and it has effects now in that there isn't a single day that I don't think of that experience and continue to be determined not to let that happen to any of my patients.
What kind of harassment has your daughter been subjected to as a result of your work?
Well, riding in and out of the driveway in a police car is, with people videotaping you and screaming at you, is one place to start. The school that she goes to has been wonderful. There had been a number of protesters that came and distributed flyers on cars parked in the parking lot and then to students out in a gym class that said that I was a member of the community and my daughter went to school there and that I killed babies and that I should be stopped. And it was a gruesome, awful piece of paper that had lots of untrue statements and ugly pictures on it. That was distributed at my daughter's school a number of different times and in the building. They also came into the building looking either for her or a picture of her in the library. We're still not sure what their ultimate motive was. And spent some time in the school. They were removed from the school, and since then the school has put in a different security system, so to speak, so that my daughter is much better protected while she's at the school building.
How has she handled it?
Well, there was one day when I was in Fargo working and got a phone call from one of the school officials and said she was in his office hysterical and that she had clenched in her fist a poster with my picture on it and allegations of murder. And she was obviously hysterical about the fact that someone was calling her mother a murderer and was distributing these flyers in her school. And that was the hardest day of all. That was kind of the turning point right there. We've talked and talked and talked about all of this, and she understands what's going on. It hurts her when people call me awful things. But she's a strong kid, and she's survived well. She's had good support from some of her friends and her friends' parents and school people and all of our family. And now she's a real strong 16-year-old who believes very strongly in certain things that she'll fight for all of her life. She's doing fine.
When you said this was a turning point, what happened afterwards?
Well, we sat down and talked about this was probably going to be as bad as it was going to get, and could she handle it? She had always been afraid, what if they come to my school? What if they come to my school? And that was the day they did come to her school. That was also the day that I agreed to do the 60-minute segment, because it was at that point that I said I'd had it. I'd absolutely had it, and people had to know what was going on. It was just too bizarre to even believe this was the United States. It was the turning point in that the worst that she could imagine had happened, and she'd lived through it, and she knew she'd survived. And by the next day, she was three notches stronger, and I was no longer near as afraid of her begging me to stop working.
She
never has.
Had she begged you before to stop?
No, she has never begged me to stop working. I was afraid that she would. I was afraid that would be the time that, if any time, that she would. But she did not and has not.
Would that have been a terribly hard choice for you if your daughter had begged you to stop working?
If my daughter had begged me to stop working, I would have stopped working.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only thing that would have stopped me.
Part of what the people who demonstrate against abortion want to do is change your mind, make you think that you are committing murder and that you have no right to do that and you should stop. Has anything that protesters have said done anything to shift your position or to get you to think in a slightly different way than you thought before?
Yes, actually. There have been a number of very interesting things that have happened to me that have made me look at the issue in different ways. Certainly not where I would stop working, and I certainly do not feel I'm committing murder, obviously. But there's been two people in the recent past that I've had very good conversations with. One of them, interestingly enough, was a lawyer who was taking my deposition in Fargo and was working with the anti-abortion people up there, defending them. And while we were doing the deposition, we got into a conversation about life and bonding between people. And it made me think about a lot of things I hadn't thought about before. Again, certainly nothing that would make me stop working. But there was parts of the things that he said that made me understand a little better why the protesters do what they do.
And that's something you want to understand.
Exactly. I do want to understand. And it's always encouraging to me when I get someone who is adamantly anti-abortion, who will sit down and talk from the heart and listen to what I say, and I'll listen to what they say. Unfortunately, 99.9% of my encounters with the protesters are people screaming at me as I go to and from the clinic, and they are not reasonable people, and they do not behave in reasonable ways, and they do not carry on reasonable conversations. But there's been two people, as I mentioned, in the recent past that I've had very good conversations with, and I'm willing to learn all the time. But I'll do it only with reasonable people.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Susan Wicklund directs the Montana Country Women's Clinic in Bozeman, Montana. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, computer networks. More and more people are logging on to them and becoming involved in communities of people they know only through their computers. We'll talk with Howard Rheingold, author of the new book Virtual Community, about sharing information, expertise, and gossip by computer. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Nightmare Before Christmas, the new movie by Tim Burton. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. A U.S. Coast Guard cutter has fired warning shots across the bow of a Haitian-bound merchant ship that refused to change course. The Coast Guard vessel is helping enforce a U.N. embargo against Haiti. NPR's Martha Raddatz reports.
The ship that was fired on, the Don Jose, is registered in the Caribbean islands. The Defense Department says the shots were fired because officers who boarded the ship were not allowed to inspect some of the cargo. The UN embargo prohibits weapons and petroleum products from entering Haiti. When the Don Jose refused to divert its course as instructed, the Pentagon says two 10-round machine gun bursts were fired into the water across the bow. The Don Jose then headed north away from Haiti. There was no damage reported to either vessel. This is the seventh ship intercepted since the U.S. and Canadian vessels began enforcing the embargo on Tuesday. Only one of the ships was carrying prohibited items. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
In Haiti, gunmen are said to have kidnapped an ally of ousted President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Family members said that the National Assembly member was dragged from a house late yesterday after only recently coming out of hiding. Meanwhile, for the first time since a UN embargo was imposed earlier this week, lines of cars formed at service stations in the capital. It's believed that Haiti has about 3 months' supply of fuel, but there appears to be a slowdown in deliveries. President Clinton has defended his health care plan against attacks, and he explained the reason for a delay in submitting the final plan to Congress. NPR's Martha Liasson reports.
The president's plan has been attacked for creating a new bureaucracy in the form of giant health alliances that would pool consumers into big purchasing cooperatives. The president said those alliances would be able to bargain for more cost-efficient health care than individuals or small businesses can today. The president also denied that his goal of providing health insurance for all Americans by the end of 1997 was too ambitious. Unless we provide insurance for everyone, Clinton said, I don't think we'll ever get costs under control. In addition, the president explained why the introduction of his health care legislation has been delayed. Mr. Clinton said the cost figures in the plan had to be recalculated to reflect higher expected inflation rates. There was no problem with the policy, the president said. We just wanted to make the Congress and the public feel better about the costs. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
The government says that the number of people filing new claims for jobless benefits went up in the latest reporting period. The Labor Department says that new claims were up by 6,000 in the week ending October 16th. At the same time, new claims for the week before were revised upward to 344,000 from 329,000. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 9 points to close at 3,636 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. On Capitol Hill, the Senate turned back an effort to curb the ability of the president to send troops to Haiti. By a vote of 81 to 19, the Senate voted against a motion by Republican Senator Jesse Helms. Then by a vote of 98 to 2, the Senate approved a non-binding measure that says Mr. Clinton should first seek approval from Congress before sending troops to Haiti. This compromise was worked out between Senate Republican leader Robert Dole and the White House in 3 days of talks. At first, Dole had supported a measure similar to that of Helms, saying at the time it was in the best interest of the president to have prior congressional approval. Israel and the PLO have agreed to release some Palestinian prisoners in the next few days. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
According to a joint statement issued in the Egyptian resort town of Taba, the two sides agreed that prisoners in four categories would be released first: those sick, under 18, over 50, and women. No number was mentioned, but between 700 and 800 prisoners are believed to fall into this category. The statement said the prisoner release would continue gradually over the next 2 months of negotiations. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin today said Israel is holding a total of 9,500 prisoners, lower than the Red Cross number of 12,000. Palestinians are demanding that all of these prisoners be released, but Israel has apparently not agreed to free the 500 to 600 who are in jail for having killed Israelis or those from the Islamic fundamentalist Hamas movement. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
The German Central Bank has lowered two interest rates in a move closely watched by other markets around the world. Banking officials cut the German discount rate and the Lombard rate by half a point each. Other nations in Europe had urged a cut in the German interest rates in hopes that it will stimulate slow economic growth in Europe, where unemployment is now at 11.5%. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The new frontier is electronic communications, and everyone wants in on the action. Last week, the phone company Bell Atlantic and the cable company Telecommunications Inc. announced plans to merge. They're hoping to be key players in the creation of the information superhighway that would interconnect video, phones, and computers. My guest Howard Rheingold is the author of a new book about computer networks called Virtual Community. He's worried that mega corporations will try to commercialize and control those computer communities. A lot of his book is about the Internet, the network of computer networks that connects people around the world. They share information, expertise, opinions, and gossip through their computers. To understand the implications of the planned merger, you need to know something about the new technology.
When you connect a computer to the telephone network, and that's what a computer bulletin board system is. It's an affordable computer that you plug into your telephone with a device known as a modem. You create, in essence, a new medium, and that medium has characteristics that other communication media have not had. One of them is that it enables people to connect with each other in new ways. That's what I mean by virtual communities. You can connect with people who may be in another part of the world, who you may not know, but you share an interest with them. And there's a great power that comes from that. The second characteristic that's important is that it's a many-to-many medium. Instead of a broadcast medium where you either need a lot of money to buy airtime or you need paratroopers to capture the broadcast station, this is an instance in which every citizen can be a publisher, every citizen can be an eyewitness or a broadcaster, simply because every node on the network can broadcast to every other node.
And this kind of computer communication, the computer bulletin boards, is already going on in a very, very democratic way on something called the Internet. Would you describe what the Internet is?
All right. The Internet was really funded by taxpayers' money about 20 years ago for Defense Department researchers to connect computers remotely. Now, it turned out that there was a happy side effect. Besides being able to operate different computers at a distance by connecting them over communication lines, people were able to type messages to each other and store those messages in electronic mailboxes. And it turned out that those programmers who were building the network wanted to communicate with each other a lot. That proved to be so useful that other researchers, other scientists, business people, students, educators, citizens demanded access to that, to the degree that we now have somewhere between 10 and 20 million people on the Internet exchanging electronic mail, sending files back and forth, conducting debates, building communities. It's really exploded from the grassroots. This was nothing that was planned to be a mass medium.
You describe the Internet as the largest functioning anarchy in the world. In what sense is it anarchic?
Well, there's nobody who tells you whether you can have a forum or not. There's no central control to it, really. People choose which areas they subscribe to and which areas they send their information out to. It's radically decentralized. You know, when I talked about broadcast media, the first thing that happens in a political coup is you try to capture the television station. Well, you can't really capture the Internet station because it's every node along the line. You have to eliminate either the entire communications infrastructure of a country, or you have to go house to house and take every computer. And we saw that during Tiananmen Square and the political upheaval in the Soviet Union, that a lot of information got out that would not have otherwise got out because it is so decentralized.
Now, last week, there was a merger between Bell Atlantic, a phone company, and Telecommunications Incorporated, a cable giant. This is the biggest media merger in history. And the CEO of Telecommunications Inc. said, "This will allow us to control all the communication needs of a household with one device." What's the device?
The device, they hope, will be a set-top box that will be an adjunct to the television set that will control the video coming in and maybe coming out, that will control all of the communications that perhaps are happening on the Internet now. I think that that's a very frightening idea, and that we as citizens, whether we are interested in technology or not, need to understand that communication is really at the basis of democracy, and that control of the means by which citizens communicate with each other is a political act.
What are your fears of big industry getting more into the act?
Well, I think a good example of what has happened in the past is the personal computer industry happened because the big boys in the computer industry were looking the other way. Steve Wozniak, when he invented the Apple I, tried to sell it to Hewlett-Packard, and Hewlett-Packard wasn't interested. So these kids in their garages created a technology that gives a lot of power to citizens. They created an industry, which is now a very large one. I believe that Microsoft is bigger than General Motors. The big boys are not looking the other way now. Will they be able to use their power and their size and their money to restrain the Steve Jobses and Steve Wozniaks and Bill Gates of the future from starting new industries, from showing us new things we can do with this technology? Or is it going to be the same old thing?
My guest is Howard Rheingold, author of the new book, Virtual Community. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Howard Rheingold, is the author of a new book about computer networks called The Virtual Community. Your new book, Virtual Community, is about different computer networks that have sprung up here and around the world. The first computer network that you signed onto is called The Well. Why don't you describe what The Well is?
Well, The Well is the Whole Earth Electronic Link. It was started by the same people who started the Whole Earth Catalog and the Whole Earth Review, and it was meant to bring this computer conferencing medium that the elites have had access to ordinary people like you and I. It's not just for computer nerds, and I'm a writer. I'm interested in computers because they help me do that. I'm not an engineer. I connected with this service because I could do it for $2 an hour and quickly found out that it really wasn't about technology. It was about people. It was about finding somebody to help me when I found a tick on my daughter's head.
Yeah, why don't you tell that story?
Well, you know, when you're in the other room, typing on a computer and communicating with someone who's not there, then the person you live with gets a little curious about what's going on and can cause a strain in that relationship. The night my wife really understood what was happening with The Well was when we found a tick on our baby's head in the middle of the night. And fortunately, that's a kind of minor thing. But to young parents, that's a crisis. She called the pediatrician. I logged on to The Well. By the time we got the call back from the pediatrician, I had received instructions from a doctor on The Well who told me what to do with the tick. Now, the light bulb went on in my wife's head. She realized, oh, those people out there, they're not only having fun, but they're helping each other. And that was illustrated in a much more poignant manner a few months later, when one of the people who participated in the parenting conference on The Well, a place where we talk about our kids, revealed that his son had been diagnosed with leukemia. Within minutes, there was a task force organized of people to support that friend, not only with the kind of emotional support that another parent can give you, but kind of information that a pediatric oncology nurse and a couple of doctors and a couple of people who have had blood disorders had to offer. That kind of reaching out to people in the real world, that kind of help to people, has nothing to do with technology, has everything to do with community, and that's what I want to see remain alive. They can have their 500 channels, they can have their video on demand. Let's leave a green belt so citizens can help each other and build communities.
You've been logging on to networks since the mid-80s, and in that time, a lot of other people have logged on, too. And I wonder if you've seen changes because of that, if it's, as it becomes more popular, as more and more people are participating, is the nature of the conversation changing?
Yes. Well, you know, when I started on the well, it was about 500 people about 8 years ago, and it's about 9,000 people now. It's like you live in a town of 500 people. You see everybody every day. You know most of the people. You leave your doors unlocked. When a town of 500 grows to a town of 9,000, you don't know everybody. You don't trust everybody. You don't leave your doors unlocked. So that effect has happened worldwide. Norms, the way people elaborate rules among themselves rather than rules that are given to them by some authority, that takes time to emerge. And the population online is growing faster than the norms are emerging. So there is conflict on the net. This is not a utopia. People can get into quite violent, although only verbally violent, disagreements with one another. So we're seeing a lot of turmoil in the culture as it is expanding. I think that turmoil is ultimately very rich, and that it is from debate and from having contact with people you don't agree with that understanding and democracy emerges.
Well, you're saying, you know, now that the town isn't just a town of 500 anymore, you can't leave the doors unlocked. What kind of bad things can happen when the population grows?
The medium itself has certain characteristics that are both good and bad, depending on how you use it. The fact that you don't know the race or age or nationality or physical appearance of the people you're communicating with, that erases a lot of barriers that usually tend to separate people. People communicate with each other in ways that they didn't communicate with each other before, and they communicate with people that they wouldn't have communicated with before. That grandma who wouldn't even make eye contact with those teenage boys who are hanging out downstairs from where she lives might have a lively discussion with them as soon as she gets into her apartment. That same characteristic, however, masks a lot of human communication. The kind of nuances on communication that you get from tone of voice, facial expression, body language, those are also absent, and therefore miscommunications can occur and people can deceive each other. We had this case on the well where there was an online Casanova who turned out to be romancing three separate women at a distance, and none of them knew about each other until they started comparing notes. It's easy to deceive people. I think we need to learn that just because you may share intimate facts of your life by typing on a computer with some stranger, that you don't necessarily want to trust that stranger with certain aspects of your life.
Have you been deceived?
Have I been deceived? Sure. Have I been cheated out of anything? Not really. I think that you have to distinguish between a medium that enables you to make connections with people and the kinds of relationships that follow from those connections. Once you have found someone who shares an interest with you, you really can't develop a true, deep friendship unless you share something in real life, the place where your body is. Unless you meet that person, you learn what it's like to be with them, you have some kind of shared experience with them, that's not really the kind of foundation for friendship and trust that I would like to have in my life.
Now, I want you to know that the last time I interviewed you, and this was about virtual reality, a few people logged on to their computers, and I think this was in the well, to say that, unfortunately, my interview with you is just another generic interview about virtual reality. So my questioning of you the last time around did not get good reviews on the Internet. So we'll see if there's any response this time.
But another characteristic of this medium is that it's a dissent amplifier.
Yes, that's right.
a few bad reviews by people who are outspoken may have a disproportionate effect. There may have been hundreds of people who thought it was great. And in fact, this program reaches more of the people that I normally communicate with than any other medium. I've been on all three networks and on primetime television. I've been in the major news magazines. All I ever hear is, gee, I heard you on Fresh Air last week. There's a tremendous reach here.
Well, we'll see what the people on the internet have to say about that.
Right. Well, we will know this afternoon. People are going to be talking about it on the internet. And you know, it's another channel to the news. When something big happens in the world now, the regime at our house is you turn on CNN and you log on to the well. During Tiananmen Square, during the Soviet coup, during the Gulf War, I had access to people giving eyewitness reports. In fact, during the events in Moscow a couple of weeks ago, I logged on to the well, and there was email that was being posted because someone's daughter was in Moscow looking out her window, describing what she was seeing that CNN was not seeing. She was transmitting that from Moscow to her father via the internet. He was posting it for us all to see. I think increasingly we will see that citizens are going to be eyewitnesses and sources of news information and misinformation.
That's it, Howard. I want to stop you right there. Misinformation. We only have a few seconds here, but how do you know who to trust? If you don't really know the person and somebody's logging on and they're describing something, how do you know it's accurate? If doctor's giving you an information, how do you know they're a real doctor?
We have access to a lot of information from a lot of people now. We also have access to a lot of misinformation. We are going to have to develop some kind of community means of determining who you can trust and who you can't trust. And I think in any community, you can ask people. I knew that that doctor who gave me advice was a real doctor and knew what he was talking about because I had interacted with him before and because several people I trust told me to trust him.
Howard Rheingold is the author of the new book, The Virtual Community. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
We'll be hearing about the kidnapping in Haiti today from Alan Tomlinson. Also, news of some progress in the talks between Israel and the PLO, the beginnings of mass releases of prisoners held by Israel-Palestinian prisoners, but also another death, a killing in Gaza of a very prominent moderate Fatah leader by, it seems, other Palestinians. Also today, Sylvia Poggioli reports on the city of Sarajevo, once prided itself on how well people of all religions got together there. Now it's becoming increasingly Islamicized as a result of the civil war, and many non-Muslims are starting to feel uncomfortable there.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Eleven years ago, Tim Burton was an animator working at Walt Disney and dreaming of making a feature-length animation about a Christmas gone wrong. Then he directed Beetlejuice, Batman, Edward Scissorhands, and Batman Returns, and became one of the few Hollywood directors who could make just about anything he wanted. What he wanted, of course, was to produce the feature-length animation he dreamed of, which his old Disney colleague, Henry Selick, has now directed. It's called Tim Burton's Nightmare Before Christmas, and film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
For a child, Nightmare Before Christmas is probably going to be, by turns, scary, funny, haunting, and incomprehensible. But for a grown-up, well, your first reaction is likely to be, wow, this really looks hard to do. It is. Nightmare Before Christmas is a product of stop-motion animation, which means instead of making drawings, the filmmakers create puppets and other objects and then painstakingly adjust them a millimeter or two every frame to achieve the illusion of motion. The original King Kong was a stop-motion character, and so was Gumby. And so, in a way, are claymation figures, like the California Raisins. But all those things pale next to the panoply of witches and vampires and gremlins and elves that make up Tim Burton's nightmare. Even though the movie is shot in a color-drained palette that makes it almost seem like black and white, this is one of the most visually startling films in recent memory. Its characters touch a dozen different bases, from Charles Adams to Maurice Sendak to Edward Gorey, all of them twitching and creeping and cackling at once. The premise is a little strange. It seems that most of our major holidays are controlled by various towns. There's Easter Town and Thanksgiving Town and Christmas Town and Halloween Town, which is where most of the movie's action takes place. Year after year, Halloween Town devotes itself to making its namesake holiday good and scary, but the master of its revels, a bony creature named Jack Skellington, is having a bit of a midlife crisis. He's fed up with Halloween, wants new worlds to conquer. And that's when he ventures into Christmas Town, which he explores with utter amazement, singing all the way.
What's this? What's this? There's something very wrong. What's this? There's people singing songs. What's this? The streets are lined with little creatures laughing. Everybody seems so happy. Have I possibly gone daffy? What is this? What's this? There's children throwing snowballs instead of throwing heads. They're busy building toys, and absolutely no one's dead. There's frost in every window. Oh, I can't believe my eyes. And in my bones, I feel the warmth that's coming from inside. Oh, look, what's this? The hanging mistletoe. They kiss? Why, that looks so unique. Inspired! The gathering around. Here is story roasting chestnuts on a fire. What's this?
The idea is that Jack decides that he and his Halloween Town minions should take over Christmas, redesigning it in their own idiosyncratic fashion, and even kidnapping Santa Claus, whom they think is some kind of lobster man named Sandy Claus. By the time Jack has launched his own coffin-shaped sleigh, with lots of charming gifts for the kids like shrunken heads and snakes that devour Christmas trees, grown-ups may find themselves in a state of bemusement. Fascinated by the design, indifferent to the uninspired songs by Danny Elfman, and a little bit put off, maybe, by a story whose central character, Jack Skellington, never quite gels. He's part mad scientist, part sad sack, part monster, part hero. Will kids like him any better? If they're under six, I'd say don't take him at all, since Tim Burton's nightmare may well become theirs, and hence yours. But older kids will probably love this movie, because even if Jack doesn't captivate them, the hundreds of ghouls and beasties and boogeymen dancing around him surely will. They'll get you, too, if you don't watch out.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Nancy Greenlease and Peter Clowney. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the blues musician Eric Clapton called the best guitarist alive, Buddy Guy. And an interview with jazz singer Annie Ross, formerly of Lambert Hendricks and Ross. She's featured in the new film Shortcuts. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next archive edition of Fresh Air.